When did you first know you had a penchant for comedy? And how did that translate into a career?
Well, you know, there is something about the Newfoundland character that is very funny. And people are very, some people are very witty and dry here. And my family, my parents really, and, you know, my older brothers and sisters, they really valued comedy, being funny, coming back with a witty and fast remark. And, you know, really basically you could get away with anything as long as you were funny. And if you weren't funny, you might as well go and hang yourself because there was every possibility you wouldn't even get fed. So that comedy is a very important part of our whole, the structure of our culture. And people who have a fast wit are generally, you know, I didn't really. I grew up with my two maiden aunts and an uncle who also were not the same as my parents. But when I would visit my parents, I would say something that I thought was funny, and the entire family would kind of go, and then carry on. You know, so I knew the value of comedy for sure. But we had a kind of, we dealt with mostly in my large family was, you know, more sarcasm and that kind of, you know, the fast and witty put down. So I just wasn't very good at that, not very fast and all that. Anyway, I wanted to be a journalist. That's what I really wanted to be. And but I didn't do, after a certain point, after a certain age, I started to fail very badly in everything. And so I really didn't have the marks to get into school. And I decided I would marry this American guy from Colorado. So I went down there with him. That was a complete and utter disaster. But then I wouldn't go home. Everybody wanted me to go home, but I wouldn't go home because I thought, well, what else am I going to do? Dear God, this is my plan. And now I'm screwed. Anyway, I came home, got very kind of depressed, I guess, which seems to be fairly common in the 18 to 20 year olds, you know, where you, and I got a job by, I fell into a job. I was watching Coronation Street quite depressed on the couch at Aunt May's. And they said they were looking for a summer replacement for a morning show at CBC, which just happened to be across the street from us, the radio building. I went down and I was so secure that I wouldn't get it. I don't even know why I went. You know how these things happen and they're complete. Anyway, I got the job, was complete failure at the job too. But anyway, on the radio, someone, Dudley Cox, was starting a theater company, an amateur theater company in the basement of the theater, the Arts and Culture Center. And he heard me on the radio and he called me up and asked me to do it. And then I got in with a crowd, you know, the way you do. Tommy Sexton was in it. And then we started to do semi-professional theater. Then we all went off to Toronto and I went to theater school at Ryerson. Everybody else was working. And then Tommy and Diane got some money from Theatre Past Mry, Paul Thompson, God love him. Theatre Past Mry in Toronto seems to be at the basis of so much that is good in theatre in this country, to me anyway. He gave them $300, I think, to do their own auditioning for him. And so I didn't really want to do it because you weren't allowed to do theatre when you were taking theatre for fear you'd get the wrong idea. And so we did a show called Caught on a Stick. You know, we worked with Greg Malone and Diane Olsen and myself and Kathy Jones and Tommy Sexton and Paul Sammets was with us at the time. And Andy Jones and Bob Joy were in England. But we used a couple of Andy's pieces that he'd done on, you know, just funny things that he'd been doing. And so he was in the show, though he wasn't in the show. His material was in the show. And I was terrible and I just was so ashamed. Like I, you know, like having gone to the nuns and all the other things, I had a high, high level of shame. So I would act, you know, I don't even know why anybody would ever want me in the thing, but I would act towards the back of the stage. That's how bad I was. So anyway, we did a big tour of Newfoundland and Andy and Bob came. Bob joined us to be part of that tour. He was at Oxford at the time and was on Halls. And then the tour was longer, so he wrote back to them and said, could he have an extension on his holidays? And they wrote back, he was at Christ Church College, I guess. He was a Rhodes Scholar. And they wrote back and said, no, he couldn't. And so he quit Oxford. and his Rhodes Scholarship, something his mother really, really, really never, ever got over and really blamed us for. She was very bitter about that for a long time. But anyway, I went on, and Andy came home, and Andy took me aside and worked with me on things, and it really helped. And then I found myself doing, we stayed together as a company, and I found myself doing it, you know, and getting better at it. And, and then when I was around 27, I kind of realized that my dream of being a journalist was kind of passing me by. And then, of course, I came up with the idea for This Hour is 22 Minutes, where I got to pretend to be a journalist on TV every week. So it was perfect for me.
It just as an extra to that question, what kinds of things were you coached on that really helped?
Oh, Andy helped me, you know, I had an awful lot of insecurity and shame. And so, you know, I can't remember now, but he would just say, look, stand there and just stand there and don't move around and just stand there and say it. Say the line like you believe in the line. I think that's basically, I think over and over and over and over, that was basically it, I think. Oh, two crows outside, two for joy. But, so I think I it's a long time ago now. You know, it was like 1973 or 1974. And then we did very well as Codco. And, then we went on from there, and we did, Kathy and I joined the Wonderful Grand Band. And then I had a TV show called Up at Hours, where I had a boarding house with Ray Guy. And I mean, I just kept going. And, and then the idea to do This Hour is 22 Minutes was, I loved when I was a youngster, that British show, That Was the Week That Was. And they had a singer, a folklore person, a folk singer on there every week who would do a song about the week too. And I had asked Ron Hines at the time, it was 1992, if he would do it. And he couldn't. His album was just taking off and stuff like that. But I had always wanted there to be a music component. And now, years after, there is, because Mike, the executive producer, and Mark Critch are both so musical that there always ends up being musical numbers in there. So that was always my dream. Not that I'm musical at all. I'm really bad at it. I can't sing at all. I always had to do, pantomime in the back because I was tall and couldn't sing. I think that's it. It's just that belief. And then it took me years, though, to get it, though Andy did put me on the road. And then I had a very bad time where I just stopped believing altogether and couldn't go on stage at all. I mean, I could, I did it. But, was really thinking, that's it. I can't do this anymore. Of course, we had a very bad crowd at the hall. I was working at the Resource Center for the Arts at the time, doing a lot of shows, doing a lot of collective, shows that were about specific things but had lots of comedy in them. And we had a bunch of people who drank way too much and would, actually heckle during a theater show. It wasn't like, really the reason that I've never wanted to be a stand-up comedian is I just don't want to be heckled. I just know I wouldn't, it was like the time I went out to ambush, the guy who was the premier. For a while, he was the mayor of Edmonton, I think, or Calgary. And then he was the premier, everybody loved him, drank too much, what's his name? Oh, for God's sake. Anyway, went out to ambush him, came in.
Ralph Klein?
Ralph Klein, yeah. And he said something that threw me off immediately. And I happened to have on this outfit that my friend Patty Parsons had made for me, which was the culmination of a lot of dreams I had as a youngster. It was a cowgirl outfit with the six guns, cap guns on the hips, and was Marg as a cowgirl. And when we were going in, Jeff Dion, who was the producer, just said to me, you were going into to the legislature in Edmonton, and Jeff just said to me very, very lightly, don't pull out the guns. I went, no, Anyway, Ralph Klein said something to me that threw me off completely. I didn't know where I was. And so I immediately went for my guns and started shooting them off in the Alberta legislature, which is really a good lesson for me. And I think one that, everyone should learn, don't have guns on your hip or near you, because something will go wrong and you will inevitably use them because they're loud and distracting. So, yeah.
So if you have to say to someone who is aspiring to be a comedian, what are the basic skills that one needs? What would you say they are?
Well, I heard someone on Seinfeld, Comedians in Cars with Coffee.
If you need a course, you're about to
forget it. A black comedian say, you know, comedians can be actors, but actors can't be comedians. Because comedians have a thing. They see things in a funny way. And I think because I came from the family that I came from, and because I'm a Newfoundlander, I do have that weird way of seeing things, or that comedic way of seeing things. And so you kind of have to have that to be a comedian. You have to have an odd way of looking at things. I'm not sure. I know that there are a lot of really great comedians who are also great actors. I'm not sure that any great actors can really be comedians. You know, there's just a certain way of looking at the world, right?
Can one acquire that, or it's just kind of natural?
I don't know if one can acquire it or not. You know, there are courses, aren't there, to teach somewhere in Humber College or something. They teach comedy. But I think that if you're attracted to comedy, no doubt you already have that on the go. You know what I mean? It's not like it's an easy life, or, you know, like, people are so angry with comedians now. And now there's the new comedy, which is not funny at all, where people cry all the time. And I think I'm for the old comedy, really. Well, because there's lots of things to make us cry. Everything, you know, there's so many shows, like, you can go to Lear and lay down and weep. But that's why years ago we came up with two things, comedy and drama. And, you know, we don't have to turn comedy. We can still have comedy, but the new comedy seems to be all about, you know, pouring your heart out. And it's not that it is bad. I mean, it's good. There's so many good new comedians, but they don't make you laugh. And I like the old comedians like Richard Pryor that make you laugh until tears run down your face. And then people are mad at comedians for saying the wrong thing. And it's a time where people take offense very easily. So I'm sure that many people, I'm doing stand-up in Halifax at the Halifax stand-up comedy festival in April. So I'm very, very nervous about it. And I was watching Richard Pryor last night, and, you know, that thing, those early things that Andy said, just stand there and say it, you know, say it like you believe it. That's all Richard Pryor was doing, as these terrible people were heckling him. They weren't heckling him about his material. They were going, "Why don't you tell us about your mom, Richard?" You know, like, but he was so comfortable. He would just go, "Don't you talk about my mom?" You know, like, "You shut up. I'm dealing with this guy." And he was just, and I don't know if I ever could get to that level of, you know, but I do find that over the years, you know, once you do stuff enough. So if you're devoted to being a comedian and you do it enough over and over again, I guess just like the craft of acting, you just get better, right? And your timing goes, you know, and you get more relaxed. Some of it is just relaxed. Like, I saw Amy Schumer do I'm sure she's really funny and people really love her, but I saw her do this thing called The Leather Show. There wasn't one funny thing in it, but she was pretty relaxed. And so that's good. And Kevin Hart, I saw him do some show where he was yelling about his kids and stuff. Just yelling. Comedians tend to yell so much, you sort of think, that's why they love that guy who used to do the, used to bring it down, because we're always out there yelling about everything, full of high energy, and yelling. And you just go, it's perhaps not a time for yelling right now, you know. It's a little, everything's a little alarming anyway, you know.
What challenges have you faced, or comedians face in general, in their career?
Well, all those things that I just said, and it isn't easy to be a woman in comedy because people are still asking that question, which, you know, I can't believe that they are, but they're still asking the question, are women really funny? You know what I mean? And, you know, I grew up with Lucy, who, you know, sort of invented sitcoms. and Mary Tyler Moore and Carol Burnett and. So it never, and my mother was funnier than everybody else in our family, though apparently my father was supposed to be funny too, my mother said, but I just never saw him. He never really got the chance. So women being funny seemed perfectly reasonable to me, but there's still a general kind of sense, you know, that we're not for some reason, you know. I don't know. And that's difficult. And then, of course, it's like Ursula Le Guin said in her thing, I have failed. I have failed completely. I'm not a man, number one, and I never could become a man, though I've tried as hard as I can. And now I'm old. I'm an old woman. What could be more failed in the world? And I just think that is so... it's called introducing myself. And, it's just the funniest piece. I don't know where it was. I don't know where it came from, what publication it was, or even when it was. But it is so perfect. She is such an amazing. She's such an amazing writer, and I don't even read her science fiction because I hate science fiction. The world. That's what's wrong with the world. Science fiction. Too much goddamn science fiction. I mean, never ending science fiction. Every show is a science fiction show. It's like the world isn't hard enough. You got to be putting in places, you know, people have superpowers that can destroy the whole world in a moment. Like, it's like, you know, just getting through the day with your son and your husband is not, you know, exhausting enough. I'd like to see more about that. What's going, you know, we don't know how to live or anything, and we're constantly off in the galaxy dealing with science fiction now. Remember when science fiction used to be one of those things that you sort of went, oh yeah, dweeby people, they read science. Now everyone, you know?
So women still face a challenge in comedy, and older women face even more of a challenge, is that?
Absolutely, absolutely. Nobody, I think older women face a challenge in the world generally, but I've been playing older women for a long time. So the great thing about being an older woman or even playing an older woman is you don't care as much. I mean, that is what helped me get through that terrible stage paralysis was when I stopped trying to be the object of somebody's desire and became the subject of my own life by playing an older woman or a granny or something. And then I could speak freely. I don't know, it's probably not going to work for others, but it opened me up and freed me up to be able to be myself as I was playing. So I still find it hard to, you know, do myself. I find it easier to be someone else, you know, but of course they're all me anyway. So, you know, but I'm hiding behind that little facade. Yeah, yeah.
What can be learned from comedy, and how might this be translated into the classroom, in young classrooms, elementary school and high school?
Well, first of all, we have to start telling the truth about who we are and what we've done. You know, Canadian history in no way, reflects that we didn't discover Canada, but we in fact invaded Canada. Like a Cree chief said there not long ago, it'd be hard, it's hard to discover a country that's already fully populated. And then he said, it'd be like if I went over to and discovered England now, you know? And so we've got to stop that nonsense, you know? And we've got to tell the truth, because when we accept that this is what happened, then we can start to change. But while we're in denial, while we're saying, you know, what is wrong with them? I wrote a show with a lot of people, some of them Indigenous people, and we took young Indigenous and settler people on the road, and we did a show called Canada is Complicated. And we talked a lot about the broken treaties, and we talked a lot about, you know, how we just came over. Like, you know, like my favorite is, you know, when the Americans landed 9/11 in Gander, and the Gander crowd took care of them, you know, it's... you know, there's even a Broadway play about it called Come From Away. But say if they stayed 500 years, like, do you think the Gander crowd would still be feeding and taking care of them, or, you know, came from away and never went back? That's what we did. And we depended totally on the Indigenous people of this country to help us through those first 200 years that we were here. You know, what good was the wheel? The European wheel was no good for us. We had to learn how to use a canoe, all the things that made people who lived here know how to live here. So we found that people were very open. We did song, dance, and comedy. And that the message, it's like, you know, Mary Poppins, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. So a bit of comedy helps the truth go down. And it isn't like somebody standing there going, and then you get, because there's no point in that. But the fact of facing the facts of the matter will actually, you know, they always say the truth will make you free. It'll make you mad first, but it'll make you free. And as we go around constantly using all our energy to deny what the truth is, then we never get a chance to move forward, you know. So, yeah, I think comedy, really, we found right across the country that people were very, very open to the message because they got it with a laugh. And so laughing opens your heart, and sometimes things get in that wouldn't be there, wouldn't be allowed in if you weren't laughing.